Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to your leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Associate Editorial Director with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Dr. Carolina Ferrero Testa, a scientific researcher and clinical data manager at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She spoke with us about recent research that she and colleagues presented at the American Epilepsy Society annual meeting on post-stroke epilepsy, as well as the ongoing efforts to manage seizures occurring after stroke, what studies still need to explore, and much more. So without further ado, let's dive in.
My name is Carolina Ferreira Tuesta. I'm a medical doctor originally from Colombia, and I'm currently working as a researcher at the Department of Neurology at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. So what made me do this study was, so I was working in UCL in London with a bunch of researchers, one of them, Dr. Marian Galovich, who published a very important paper in this field in seizures after stroke called, in Lancet Neurology, called the SELECT score. And this, when he was presenting his results, one question came up, and that was, what's the actual effect of reperfusion therapies that we know it's very important in the stroke field? So what's the effect of those therapies in the risk of developing post-stroke seizures? Our hypothesis was, oh, so reperfusion could eventually reduce the chances of post-stroke seizures. So therefore, it could have a protective effect. However, I looked into the literature and the results were, there was a lot of heterogeneity in the results. So we decided to do this study and look more closely into these factors. We had the advantage that we had a really large multi-center cohort with this type of data. So we decided to perform some novel statistics. Novel for us, they've been there for ages, but novel for us, with this data to basically obtain, determine the effect of reperfusion in the risk of post-stroke seizures while controlling for something that's called selection bias, which we thought was the main factor affecting or leading to this increased heterogeneity in the previous results.
That makes sense. So, obviously, you take these steps to kind of weed out, the nonsense or the noise, I guess, for lack of a better phrasing. So ultimately, I mean, what was found? What are kind of the conclusions that have been made based on the experience?
So the goals of our study were mainly two. One, to identify the factors associated with post-stroke seizures. That was number one. And the second one was to actually determine the association between reperfusion and seizures. And for these, so the main factors for the first goal, we identify the common factors, severity of stroke, a type of stroke, location of a stroke, et cetera, et cetera. And for the second goal, which was my main concern, we saw that reperfusion therapy does not affect the risk of post-stroke seizures. So as I said before, in the past, there were some studies suggesting that the use of reperfusion, in particular, something called RTPA, which we know it's the main drug used in thrombolysis. So that this particular drug, the previous studies showed that this particular drug could actually increase the risk of a stroke due to several mechanisms. However, in our study, we found, using one of the largest cohorts analyzing this association, we found out that this dissociation is there's no significant association between these two factors, and that is likely that the previous associations were basically due to selection bias. So, and what I mean with selection bias is that patients with more severe strokes that have more chances to develop post-stroke seizures are also patients that are more likely to receive reperfusion. So this association, this overall association, was being driven by that particular group that had a really high chance of developing seizures.
And so, I mean, so that finding then, I mean, I imagine that was kind of, I don't want to say, it's always tough to say surprising or unexpected because you don't go into a study sort of expecting anything, but was that sort of difference that, you know, this association wasn't shown, was that kind of a shock to you guys? Was that what you were expecting to see or?
So there are a couple of things there. So first of all, the pivotal trials in stroke do not mention post-stroke seizures. So we don't know, or from those trials, from those thrombolysis trials, we don't know if there's an actual association or if they saw an association between these therapies and seizures. To be honest, we were not expecting a significant association as we showed it. However, some of us thought, you know, maybe thrombolysis or mechanical thrombectomy or the time between stroke and perperfusion could actually reduce the risk of post-stroke seizures because you're basically saving more cortex, which is where seizures occur. So if you prevent that ischemic cascade to like travel through a cortex and you stop it early, then it's less likely for you to experience seizures. However, what we found out was there was no association, which was a little bit surprising in the way that related to what I said before.
So, and then how does that kind of inform clinical care? Because I imagine, obviously, you know, that there is a concern for these seizures to occur in patients after stroke. But, you know, what's kind of the current, you know, I guess, process for treating them? Are these patients put on anti-seizure medications? And how does this data kind of help inform that process?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, we don't have the best answer yet. So there are some studies showing that the use of anti-seizure medication in the early period after stroke do not affect the long-term outcomes. So basically, when you have a stroke and you have seizures, you can have seizures either in the earliest stage, that is 7 days after stroke, or in the later stage, that is after 7 days after a stroke. And if you have seizures after those 7 days after a stroke, then you're categorized as post-stroke epilepsy because you have a higher risk of recurrence. If you treat the early seizures, those that occur in the first 7 days after a stroke, the likelihood of developing post-stroke seizures does not change. It's the same. After those first, so basically what we do in those cases is that we treat the symptomatic seizures. We obviously give them anti-seizure medication because they're having a seizure and we need to stop it. So we treat that seizure, but we eventually stop the medication. If the seizure occurs in the long term, and given that it's considered post-stroke epilepsy, if seizures occur in the long term, we initiate anti-seizure medication as a therapeutic management for the epilepsy itself. So these patients will continue to receive anti-seizure medication in the long term. Now, how does our findings change the management? Well, basically, they don't change the management. They basically mean that what we're doing is fine. And these patients should, even if the patient is maybe a little bit scared about having seizures after a stroke or something like that, we can tell them with certainty that the treatment of a stroke itself is not increasing the risk of having or not having seizures. That basically post-stroke seizures are the result of this traumatic event that happened in their brain and is linked to mechanisms related to stroke, but is not linked to mechanisms related to management of the stroke. And given that, it's important to emphasize and to tell our patients that the management of a stroke is key and is very important, and that this management should, or like the fear or the risk of developing seizures should not change their decision or their need or their idea about the stroke management itself.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Otesta to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, the FDA has accepted Santhera Pharmaceuticals and ReveraGen Biopharma's NDA for their investigational agent, Valmorolone, for the treatment of patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The application is supported by phase 2B data from the Vision DMD study, and the FDA has scheduled a PDUFA target action date for the review of the application of October 26, 2023. Next, just a few months after AMX-35, or Relyvrio, earned FDA approval as a treatment for patients with ALS, Amylyx Pharmaceuticals has announced that it has successfully completed enrollment in its pivotal Phase 3 Phoenix study, a 48-week trial assessing the agent in 664 individuals with ALS. The top-line results of that trial are expected in 2024. Next, a group of experts convened by the Alzheimer's Association provided clarity and direction for the Alzheimer's disease community on the definition of, quote, clinically meaningful benefit, unquote, or, quote, meaningful slowing of disease progression, unquote, in Alzheimer's disease amid recent discussions about this definition, and particularly on the heels of recent advances in the therapeutic pipeline. All told, the group concluded that it is both critical to implement a treatment strategy early in the disease as well as assess change over the course of a relatively brief 18-month clinical trial as the main ways of understanding the value of an effective intervention. Finally, in a quarterly report, Sanofi announced that it has discontinued the Phase 3 URSA study assessing its BTK inhibitor tolebrutinib as a potential treatment for patients with myasthenia gravis. This followed a June 2022 partial clinical hold that was placed on the trial because of safety concerns. At the same time, though, the company announced it had completed enrollment for its Phase 3 Hercules study, which is assessing the agent in non-relapsing progressive multiple sclerosis. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com, or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Autesta.
And then, so, you know, I imagine, because that's, you know, when you're talking to a patient, if they express concern about that, I imagine, obviously, you know, what you're saying right there is number one, right? Hey, any treatment we apply here is not going to potentially make this work, which is great. So, you know, right now, I guess, how would you describe then the sort of, you know, the prognostic ability to kind of predict the odds of, you know, who are kind of, I know we have that group who's kind of very clear high risk for these seizures, but for say that, you know, the average stroke patient, how good are we at prognosticating whether or not these seizures are going to occur?
So that's basically $1 million question. And that's what we're trying to do in neurology. So we are trying to identify, like, it's very important for us to be able to identify who will eventually have seizures, either post-stroke seizures, post-traumatic seizures, epilepsy itself, any type of seizure. We're trying to identify those subjects for two main reasons. One, to like be able to identify it and initiate treatment and define protocols, follow-up protocols to be able to catch the seizure and treat it early. And second, basically to be able to have larger trials in order to find new therapy. So in order for these trials to be effective, we need to have patients that eventually will develop seizures. So we need to find those participants, those high risk participants. Now, there are a couple of models, clinical models that have been developed that help us identify the patients that have a higher risk of developing post-stroke epilepsy. And one of these models is called the SELECT model, which is the model that Marin Galovich created and his colleagues created. And this model included more than 2,000 participants from patients from epilepsy centers in Europe. And it was internally, externally validated. So basically all the statistical things you need to do in order to create one of these models were done. And the predictors or the factors that increase your risk of developing post-stroke or seizures after ischemic stroke. And I want to emphasize the difference, like the word ischemic, because for hemorrhagic stroke is different. So the predictors that increase the risk of seizures after ischemic stroke are basically having early seizures. So having seizures in the first 7 days after stroke, having an involvement or a stroke in the cortex, involving the cortex, having a very severe stroke, which is measured by the NIHSS, which is a kind of well-known scale in the stroke field, having a stroke that involves the middle cerebral artery, and finally having large artery atherosclerosis, which is one of the causes of a stroke. So the patients, if they meet one of these factors, their likelihood of developing post-stroke epilepsy will be higher. And these are the patients, even though we don't know when they're going to have post-stroke epilepsy, when are they going to have post-stroke epilepsy, we should tell them, and our role should be to just make sure that these patients that have a higher risk are followed up in a kind of consistently for a couple of years after the stroke, and make sure that they know and they're aware that seizures can occur, like informing about how a seizure looks like. And if something like, and if a seizure happens, then they should come back to us to receive therapy and management. The accuracy of these models is not perfect. We're not magicians. We're not seeing the future here. So it's basically, the accuracy is around 70%. So there's still some unknown area that we're not able to capture, which is common in the epilepsy world. So there are factors that we don't know yet how they contribute to the development of seizures.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if we could predict seizures, right, that would help across the board here. And I'm curious then, because obviously, I know, you know, post-stroke, there's monitoring and follow-up. So, you know, is there kind of a standardized protocol or a protocol that you're aware of? Is it part of maybe guidelines for management in terms of that monitoring, you know, as it specifically relates to these post-stroke seizures? You know, because you mentioned, obviously, yeah, if someone in that early period has a seizure, clearly we're going to follow up. But for those patients who maybe don't have seizures in that sort of first week window, who may then still develop them later, is that kind of part of that standard follow-up protocol?
So currently, there's no clear international guideline on how to manage and how, or on the protocols for these patients with a stroke in terms of post-stroke seizures. For a stroke, there are many international, very well validated guidelines for every participant, for every case, but not for post-stroke epilepsy. However, individual institutions have protocols, and most of these protocols will definitely include a neurological assessment in the first days, in the first month after stroke, which is kind of the high-risk moment. So they will probably ask a bunch of questions, do a lot of tests, get a lot of imaging and analysis to see how the patient is recovering and if there's something else going on. So in this period, in the first month, even up to 3 months, some institutions will follow up these stroke patients up to 3 months, which is kind of part of the stroke protocol. And during this time, these participants will be asked about seizures and if there's something related to seizures that could be going on. However, after these acute and subacute kind of period, there's not really kind of a protocol determining how or like telling us what to do in order to like confirm or post-stroke seizures. Some institutions, and again, this is, and I'll want to come back to this later, but like this, like in developing countries, I personally come from a developing country, and the follow-up of these participants is many times limited by the system itself. We lose participants. Basically, they go back to their cities, or they just go out of the system, or something happens. So in many places, the follow-up of patients with a stroke is stopped at 3 or 6 months after the stroke. So we don't know exactly, we don't have a protocol on what to do after that. However, in developing countries, and what we should be doing is be able to follow up these participants at least for 2 years after a stroke, either by telephone, email, something, and just make sure that we're asking about seizures. And why is it important to ask about seizures? Well, seizures after stroke it has been shown that it definitely affects the recovery, the motor recovery, and the behavioral recovery of those patients. Management itself, so in case the patient is receiving anti-seizure medication, these types of medication could affect or could interfere with stroke, secondary prevention from stroke, with the drugs that we use for secondary prevention. And thirdly, it affects the quality of life. It will limit their ability to drive, if it's a young woman, it will actually have some, the woman will probably have some childbearing concerns. So there are many factors that could impact the quality of life in this patient. And that's why it's important to be able to follow up that, to follow up until 1 or 2 years after the stroke.
And I think that that kind of leads in nicely. The last thing I want to add, because, you know, I know very recently, you know, particularly in the United States, like the American Stroke Association just last year updated, you know, the post-stroke guidelines. Here's kind of what we want to do. You know, I'm curious, do you think, especially with this sort of focus, this heavy focus on secondary stroke prevention and like, shouldn't this post-stroke, see, it feels like that should kind of be included in that process. Is that a limitation of like the available literature? Is there just like not enough information to provide a clear guidance? Or, because that's my last question was going to be sort of what follow-up work would you like to see? And I imagine if that's kind of one of those limiting factors to adding that to the guidelines, is that where we're at? Or is it just that hasn't been included for another reason?
In terms of like what we want to do next, so I agree there's a need to include post-stroke seizures in the stroke guidelines, in the follow-up protocols. We have, even though it's not as large as the stroke data, we have a significant amount of data showing many associations, showing how these patients behave over time and the nature somehow of the disease. However, there is, in addition to that, there are two other kind of hot topics right now that we're trying to look into. One is to be able to describe with more certainty what is post-stroke epileptogenesis, what is actually driving that degeneration of seizures after a stroke. There's some animal studies, some human studies, but we don't know yet what's actually going on. So that's one main focus, just basically understand what's going on. And if we understand what's going on, we're going to be able to create or develop drugs to prevent that those mechanisms, to stop those mechanisms. So that's one field. The second field is more on the prediction side. So there is, as you may have noticed, or someone interested in this field may have noticed, there's not enough information about, like, related to neuroimaging. So one of the ideas is to identify, using neuroimaging, is to identify the areas of the brain that are more vulnerable to develop post-stroke seizures. And for that, we obviously need a very large amount of data and good quality data in order to be able to see if a stroke in some particular areas is more likely to result in post-stroke seizures. So those are the main kind of some of the main future goals that we have.
Is there anything else, you know, either from this work specifically or just kind of on the topic of post-stroke seizures that you think is either important to note or, you know, that the community is talking about that you think is kind of important to add?
Yeah, so I just would like to kind of emphasize on the need of multicenter studies and basically encourage the field to do multicenter studies and to collaborate between centers, not only in the same country, but like go and look for, try to collaborate with centers from other continents. I think this is the only way to actually create studies that are robust and that have a good power to detect effect sizes. So I will basically encourage, I would like to encourage the field to do multicenter studies, to collaborate and to basically work together to find solutions and answer to all these questions.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, you can visit neurologylive.com.